on breadboxmedia.com. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight about Catholics that are communist. There's an interesting history about this. Interesting and complex. There were subversive communists all over the world in most countries, especially in the United States. It's now extensively documented. Yale University issued a 20-volume set of the material in the KGB archives, containing name, dates, photographs of the various subversives around the world. Some of them are rather surprising. One Assistant Secretary of State of the U.S., he went to Yalta with Roosevelt. His name was Alger Hiss. One Secretary of the Treasury. But they were in the church, too. That's why it's a historical apologist for the Catholic Church. I'd like to spend this podcast going back to the original source and listening to Bella Dodd's words, reading them for you, giving voice to this woman, to Bella Dodd herself. At one time, Bella Dodd was a senior official in the Communist Party USA, CPUSA. And you're going to hear about her transformative encounter with Bishop Fulton J. Sheen. Well, let's start the story. Now, there's probably a few of you listeners that are old enough to remember what it was like in the USA in the 1940s and 50s. People were frightened. A lot of the press made fun of it. They called it the Red Scare. They ridiculed people for being afraid of communists under the bed. They said it was a bunch of phantoms. Well, unfortunately, as it turned out, there really were thousands of subversive, thousands. There was a woman named Bella Dodd that spoke out bravely in the 40s. We're going to listen to what she actually had to say. I'm reading from Dr. Bella V. Dodd's autobiography, School of Darkness, it's called, chapter 14. She says, I was subpoenaed by the New York County Grand Jury and interrogated at the district attorney's office. In the midst of the questioning, one of the two assistants asked me why I had become a communist. Because only the communists seemed to care about what was happening to people in 1932 and 33, I said. They were fighting hunger and misery and fascism then, and neither the major political parties nor the churches seemed to care. That's why I became a communist. I spoke with the practiced intensity of long habit, but no longer with the old faith in the cause, for I no longer had the same deep conviction about the party's championship of the poor and dispossessed. I knew that its activities were conceived in duplicity and betrayal. Bella Dodd had been interviewed by her friend, Dr. Alice von Hildebrand, who was a theologian. When she was an active party member, she had dealt with no fewer than four cardinals within the Vatican who were working for us, the Communist Party. Let me say that again. No fewer than four cardinals within the Vatican who were working for us, the Communist Party. This is from an article, The Church in Crisis, reprinted from the Latin Mass magazine of the time. Dr. Bella V. Dodd was a brilliant and dedicated woman. She was a graduate of Hunter College and then of the New York University Law School. What she said about that is this: I'm the product of the public schools of the city of New York, both elementary and high school. I went to the Hunter College where I received my AB and did my master's work at Columbia University. I worked toward a doctorate in philosophy, and then I switched into the legal division and went to New York University, where I received a degree of Doctor of Jurisprudence. This is from Dr. Dodd's testimony on November 16, 1953, when she testified to the United States House of Representatives Subcommittee on the Committee of Un-American Activities. It was a public hearing. She later became head of the New York State Teachers Union and was, of course, a member of the National Council of the CPUSA until 1949. She wrote this: I was subpoenaed by the New York County Grand Jury and interrogated at the district attorney's office. In the midst of the questioning, one of the two assistants asked me why I had become a communist. She replied, because only the communists seemed to care about what was happening to people in 1932 and 33. They were fighting hunger and misery and fascism then. Neither the major political parties nor the churches seemed to care. That's why I became a communist. She goes on. I spoke with the practiced intensity of long habit, but no longer with the old faith in the cause. Because I no longer had the same deep conviction about the party's championship of the poor and dispossessed. I knew now that its activities were conceived in duplicity and ended in betrayal. Then in 1949, in June, the Communist Party released a statement to the Associated Press announcing Belidov's expulsion from membership in the Communist Party. What happened gives all of us an important look into the New World Order, and the way in which the communist leadership treats party members who have seen the lies and deceptions of these masters of deceit. Masters of Deceit was J. Edgar Hoover's book about communism. In case some people might still erroneously think that communism is not intrinsically evil, here's more Belidov quotes. A new plan against me developed in the following weeks, a strategy of slurs, character defamation, harassments. There were, of course, still many people in the trade union movement, and especially teachers, who were not part of the inner communist circle, who remembered the days of my campaigning. Now the party decided to blacken my character publicly, so that the simple working people in the party who liked me would no longer have confidence in me. The incident, which was used as an excuse for my formal expulsion from the party, was of no importance in itself. The way in which it was handled was symptomatic of party methods. On Lexington Avenue, a few doors from my home, lived a Czechoslovakian woman with whom I sometimes talked. She lived in a small three-story building where she served as a janitor. Her husband was permanently incapacitated, and she was the sole support of his family. Now, acting as janitor and working as a domestic for several days a week, she managed to keep her family together. In 1947, the owner of the building decided to sell it. The woman, afraid she'd lose both her apartment and her job, made up her mind to buy it and borrowed the money to do so. Thus, she technically became a landlord, but her daily life remained the same. She was still a janitor. However, as owner of the house, she had become involved with her tenants, and in quick succession, three judgments were entered against her. Her husband quarreled and left her. The attorney for the plaintiffs, eager to collect his fees, asked for warrants for her arrest. At this point, she came to me for help, and I agreed to represent her. In the end, the court granted my plea, the tenants were paid, and the woman escaped imprisonment. One thing was clear. Only technically could she have been called a landlord. But the communist leader heard with delight that Belidov had appeared at, quote, attorney for a landlord, the excuse for which they'd been looking. Of course, they could have simply expelled me, but this would involve discussion of policies. They were looking for an excuse to expel me on charges that would besmirch my character, drive my friends away, and stop discussion instead of starting it. What better than to expel me for the crime of becoming, quote, a hireling of the landlords? They also said I had made remarks against the Puerto Rican tenants, that I had slandered them and showed myself a racist, almost a fascist, and last of all, a charge of anti-Negro, anti-Semitism, and anti-working class was thrown in for good measure. On May 6th, a youth leader of the Communist Party, a round-faced, solemn youth, came to my house. I asked him in and offered him a cup of coffee, which he refused. Then he handed me a copy of written charges. When I said something about their falseness after I glanced through them, he gave me a sneering look and instructed me to appear for trial the next day at the local section office, the next day at the local section commission, a block from my house. So I climbed the endless stairs to the drab, dirty meeting room with its smell of stale cigarettes. A group was waiting for me, and I saw it consisted entirely of petty employees of the party, those at the lowest rung of the bureaucracy. The three among them had faces hard and full of hate, party faces, I thought, humorless and rigid. They sat there like fates ready to pass on the destinies of human beings. I had no quarrel with these people. In fact, as I looked at the group, I had the feeling of a schoolteacher when small children became suddenly defiant of authority. One woman, the chairman, was Finnish, another a Puerto Rican. She began shouting her hatred at me. At least it must have been hate, to judge from her expression, for her English was too hysterical to be understood. The pudgy-faced boy was there, too. Of the other three men, I recognized one as a waiter, the other as a piccolo player, whom I had befriended. This was an odd kind of trial. The commission before me had already made up its mind. I asked whether I could produce witnesses. The answer was no. I asked if I might bring the woman involved in the case to let her state the story. The answer was no. I asked if the commission would come with me to her house and speak with her and the tenants. The answer was no. Then I asked if I might bring a communist lawyer who at least understood the legal technicalities I'd been faced with in trying this simple case. The answer was no. I tried to explain the facts to them. I realized I was talking to people who had been instructed, who were hostile, and would continue despite arguments or even proof. The Finnish woman who was chairman said that I would be informed of the result. I was dismissed. My heart was heavy. The futility of my life overcame me. For 20 years I'd worked with this party, and now at the end I found myself with only a few shabby men and women, inconsequential party functionaries, drained of all mercy, with no humanity in their eyes, with no goodwill of the kind that works justice. Had they been armed, I know they would pull the trigger against me. When I reached my own house and went in, the rooms were cool and quiet. I was tired and spent, as if I'd returned from a long nightmare journey. Of course, I was certain more trouble was in store for me, to publicity against me. Clever publicity. For this expulsion had not originated in the dirty rooms of the Harlem Commission, but from the headquarters on 12th Street, and perhaps from more distant headquarters. I decided to get in touch with the one group whom I had regarded as my friend, the Teachers Union. I called them. I shouldn't have bothered. Rose Russell and Abram Lederman, leaders of the Teachers Union, had been present in the state party meeting, which engineered and confirmed my expulsion, and issued their resolution to the press. The vote was unanimous. June 17, 1949, my telephone rang. "This is the Associated Press," said a voice. "We've received a statement from the Communist Party announcing your expulsion from membership. It says here you're anti-Negro, anti-Puerto Rican, anti-Semitic, anti-labor, and the defender of a landlord. Have you any statement to make?" No comment was all I could manage to say. The New York papers carried the stories the following day, and 3 days later, the Daily Worker, the communist paper, reprinted the long resolution of expulsion. Let me interject something here. Bella Dodd was soon to find herself testifying before various committees, foreign relations committees, Senate committees in Washington, D.C. They wanted to know what she and other members of the Communist Party USA were doing regarding the infiltration of the Roman Catholic Church in general, and Catholic seminaries in particular, because at her request her testimonies about such things were off the record. And the only data currently available is whatever accounts one can find from various speeches she made. We should understand her aversion to anything in writing publicized, because she had a very real fear of assassination by a communist hit squad. We go on with her words. "I braced myself for further attacks from the party, and they came soon in terms of economic threats. The Communist Party told me there'd be no more legal referrals to me. My clients, many of them party members, came to my office with their new lawyers to withdraw their pending cases. There were telephone calls, letters, telegrams, various forms of hate and vituperation, many from people I did not know. What I'd failed to understand was that the security I felt in the party was that of a group, and that affection in that strange communist world is never a personal emotion. You were loved or hated on the best basis of group acceptance, and emotions were stirred or dulled by propaganda. That propaganda was made by the powerful people at the top. Now I wrote letters to people, some of whom had lived in my house or been frequent guests. Those who replied were either abusive or obviously sought to disassociate themselves from me. Two friends replied in one sentence on the back of the letter. I had written them only this: "Please do not involve us." Before long, my office was empty except for snoopers and predators. I gave up my home and moved into a dingy room behind my office. I sat and looked out the window at Bryant Park, at the classical lines of the public library. I'd spent many hours in that library as a student and teacher, hungry for knowledge. But I had no desire to read now. The one book I did open was the New Testament, which I'd never stopped reading, even in my days of starkest party delusion. I began to stay late at night in my office. There was no place to go other than my room, a dark, unpleasant place, with the odor of a second-class hotel. I spent Christmas there alone. I thought about leaving New York, but something stubborn in me told me I must see it through. The New York Post asked me to write a series of articles on why I'd broken with the Communist Party, and made me a generous offer. I agreed, but when I'd finished them and read them over, I did not want to see them published, and found an excuse for refusing the offer. A weekly magazine made an even more lucrative offer. I refused that too. I could not trust my own conclusions, and I could not bear to hurt people I'd known in the party, and for whom I still felt affection. Some I knew were entrapped as surely as I'd been. allow me to interject something else. It seems that Belladonne was indeed afraid of being assassinated. It seems to be confirmed by something she wrote concerning her chance meeting with Christopher McGrath in Washington, D.C. Here's the words of Belladonne. Christopher asked me if I wanted FBI protection, and I must have shivered noticeably, though I was afraid I was reluctant to live that kind of life. He did not press the issue. He said, I know you're facing danger, but if you won't have that protection, I can only pray for your safety. It was a strange and painful year. The process of completely freeing oneself from being a communist is a thing no outsider can understand. The group thinking, the group planning, and the group life of the party had been a part of me for so long that it was desperately difficult for me to be a person again. But I had begun the process of unbecoming a communist. It was a long and painful process. March of that year, an old friend, Wellington Rowe, came into my office. He breezed in with a smile, said he was just passing through. Duke had been one of the party's front candidates in the American Labor Party. I told him about my articles, and he said he wanted to see them. Then he talked of events in Washington. I told him I'd been so immersed in my own troubles, I paid little attention to events. He asked if I had any opinion of Senator Joseph McCarthy. I didn't have much to say about that. Then he asked if I had ever known Owen Lattimore. I said I had not. Had I ever known Owen Lattimore to be a party member, he asked. And again, I said no. I'd heard of him vaguely. A few weeks later, Duke came to my office again and asked if I'd be willing to help Professor Lattimore. He talked about the importance of having all liberals unite to fight the reaction, wherever it is manifesting itself. Then Duke came again, and this time he brought a man with him he introduced as Abe Fortas, Lattimore's attorney. I didn't know him or Lattimore, but I'd heard of him through mutual friends as a man who often defended civil service employees who were faced with loyalty probes. Abe Fortas said he thought he would have to subpoena me in the defense of Lattimore. He saw that I was reluctant, and he asked if I'd be willing to give him an affidavit saying I had not heard of Lattimore while I was a leader in the Communist Party. So I signed an affidavit to that effect. I thought that was the end of it. That was naive. A few days later, I was served with a subpoena from the Foreign Relations Committee of the U.S. Senate. I called Duke. He said it was no surprise to him. He'd be happy to make a reservation for me. He'd even rent a typewriter so I could prepare a statement. Now, some among my listeners here on Breadbox Media may know about Senator Joseph McCarthy. He's a Roman Catholic senator and an active anti-communist. His name and reputation have been dragged through the mud by communist propaganda in this country. He's generally poorly thought of. But he was well thought of at the time. Matter of fact, he was the godfather of one of Robert Kennedy's children. Let's go on with Belladonne. At the hearing, I saw Lattimore for the first time. Duke was there, too. At a table sat Senator Tidings, and with him sat Senator Green of Rhode Island, Senator McMahon of Connecticut, Senator Lodge of Massachusetts, and Senator Hickenlooper of Indiana. Back of them sat Senator McCarthy, and next to him Robert Morris. I studied the senators before me. I knew that Senator Tidings from Maryland was related in some way to Joseph Davies, the ambassador to Russia who had written the friendly mission to Moscow, and who had been active in the Russian war relief effort, receiving an award from the Soviet Propaganda Center in the United States. I knew of Senator McMahon's proposal for sharing our atomic knowledge with Russia. Well, I did not want to be drawn into what I thought was a Democratic-Republican fight. There's no doubt in my mind that on the facts of which I had knowledge, I told the truth. But I answered the committee's questions with emotion. I reacted as a communist and answered as a communist. I'd broken with the structure of the party, but was still conditioned by the pattern of its thinking, still hostile to its opponent. But something happened to me at this hearing. I was at last beginning to see how ignorant I had become, how long since I'd read anything except party literature. I thought of the systematic rewriting of Soviet history, the blotting out of any mention of such persons as Trotsky. I thought of the purges. I, too, wanted the answers to the questions Senator Hickenlooper was asking, and I wanted the truth. I found myself hitting at the duplicity of the Communist Party. My appearance before the Tidings Committee had served one good purpose. It had renewed my interest in political events. It had the effect of breaking the spell which held me. I had at last spoken openly and critically of the Communist Party. To those who find it difficult to understand how mine can be imprisoned, my puny indictment of the Communist movement before the Tidings Committee may seem slight indeed, for I no doubt gave some comfort to the party by my negative approach, but it takes time to unbecome a communist. The event had been important to me, to myself. I could now breathe again, and I lived again in a world so long lost to me. I read the congressional report of the hearings on the Institute of Pacific Affairs. My store of odd pieces was beginning to develop into a recognizable picture. There had been many things I had not really understood. I had regarded the Communist Party as a poor man's party, and thought of the presence of certain men of wealth within it accidental. I now saw this was no accident. I regarded the party as a monolithic organization with the leadership in the National Committee and the National Board. Now I saw this was only a facade placed there by the movement to create an illusion of the poor man's party. It was in reality a device to control the common man they so raucously championed. Now I realize that with the best motives and a desire to serve the working people of my country, I and thousands like me had been led to a betrayal of these very people. I now saw that I had been poised on the side of those who sought the destruction of my own country. I realized how the Soviets had utilized Spain as a preview of the revolution to come. Now other peoples had become expendable, the Koreans, North and South, Chinese soldiers, and the American soldiers. I found myself praying God help them all. What now became clear to me was a collusion of these two forces. The communists, with their timetable for world control, and certain mercenary forces in the free world, bent on making profit from blood. But I was alone with these thoughts. It was a clear, crisp day later on, and I walked along Pennsylvania Avenue toward the Capitol. Near the House Office Building, I ran into an old friend, Christopher McGrath, the congressional representative of the 27th District, the old East Bronx area of my childhood. I'd not seen him for more than a year. When I last saw me, he had taken me to lunch, giving me some advice. He greeted me warmly, invited me to his office. I was happy to go with him. When we were in his office, he said, "You look harassed and disturbed, Bella. Is there something I can do for you?" I felt a lump in my throat. I found myself telling him how much he had helped me the day he'd taken me to lunch, and how good it had been to talk about my mother to someone who had known him, who had known her. And in that restaurant, that noisy restaurant in Manhattan, someone had, for the first time in a long time, talked to me reverently about God. The people I'd known in my adult life had sworn in the name of God or had repeated sophisticated jokes on religion, but none had talked of God as a living personal reality. This was when he asked me if I wanted FBI protection. He looked at me closely for a moment, as if he wanted to say something. Then he said, "Bella, would you like to see a priest?" I was startled. I was amazed at the intensity with which I answered, "Yes, I would." "Perhaps we can reach Monsignor Sheen at Catholic University." We put in several calls, and an appointment was made for me late that evening at the Monsignor's home. I was silent as we drove to Chevy Chase. All the canards against the Catholic Church which I had heard and were tolerated, which even by my silence I had approved, were threatening the tiny flame of longing for faith within me. I thought of many things on that ride, of the word fascist, used over and over again by the communist press, in describing the role of the church in the Spanish Civil War. I also thought of the word Inquisition, so skillfully used on all occasions. Other terms came to me, reactionary, totalitarian, dogmatic, old-fashioned. For years they'd been used to engender fear and hatred in people like me. A thousand fears assailed me. Would he insist that I talk to the FBI? Would he insist that I testify? Would he make me write articles? Would he see me at all? and then before my mind's eye flashed the cover of a communist pamphlet, on which was a communist extending a hand to a Catholic worker. It was a reprint of a speech by the French communist leader, Thorez, and it flattered the workers by not attacking their religion. It skillfully undermined the hierarchy, the priesthood, in the pattern of the usual communist attempt to drive a wedge between a Catholic and his priest. How dared I come to a representative of that hierarchy? I rang the doorbell and was ushered into a small room. While I waited, the struggle within me began again. Monsignor Fulton Sheen walked into the room, a warm smile in his eyes. He held out his hand as he crossed the room. "I'm glad you have come." His voice and his eyes had a welcome which I had not expected. It had caught me unaware. I started to thank him for letting me come, but I realized that the words which came did not make sense. I began to cry and heard my own voice repeating over and over with agony, "They say I'm against the Negro." That accusation had made me suffer more than all the other vilification, and I, who had for years been regarded as a hard communist, wept as I felt the sting anew. Monsignor Sheen put his hand on my shoulder to comfort me. "Don't worry," he said, "this thing will pass." And he led me gently to a little chapel. We both knelt before a statue of Our Lady. I don't remember praying, but I do remember that the battle within me ceased. My tears were dried, and I was conscious of stillness and peace. When we left the chapel, Monsignor Sheen gave me a rosary. "I'll be going to New York next winter," he said. "Come to me and I'll give you instructions in the faith." In 1952, Dr. Belladonne publicly announced that several months before then, on Monday in April 7th, she'd been received back into the Roman Catholic Church. Here's what Belladonne says about this. Easter of 1952 was approaching, and Bishop Sheen said I was ready. April 7th, on the anniversary of my mother's birthday, I was baptized by Bishop Sheen in the font in St. Patrick's Cathedral. Mary Riley and Louis Pagnuco stood on either side of me. So, my listeners, after Belladonne's defection from the Communist Party in 1949, she revealed that one of her jobs as a communist agent was to encourage young radicals to enter the Roman Catholic seminaries. She claims that before she had left the Communist Party in the U.S., she had encouraged 1,100 young radicals to infiltrate Roman Catholic seminaries and religious orders. This is the way she said this. "In the 1930s, we put 1,100 men into the priesthood in order to destroy the church from within. The idea was for these men to be ordained and then climb the ladder of influence and authority as monsignors and bishops." I know in this podcast I mentioned this a little earlier, the fact that Dr. Alice von Hildebrand confirmed that Belladonne had publicly stated the same things to which she attested in her public affidavit. A Mrs. Janine Leninger confirmed that other people could also verify that Belladonne had made these statements regarding the infiltration of communists into the Roman Catholic seminaries. Mrs. Leninger had also said she herself knows some Roman Catholic priests who were sleepers, unquote. Sleepers. That's an espionage term for individuals or groups who refrain from any subversive espionage or other infiltrator functions until they become active. This Mrs. Leninger stated she knew of several priests who faithfully taught the Catholic religion until they became bishops or were promoted to other influential posts, and then upon becoming active, immediately exhibited hostility to that same faith which they had previously professed. No wonder so many of the bishops, cardinals, and pariti, that's the theological experts, at the Synod of Vatican II were so virulently anti-Catholic and extremely hostile to almost everything that is really part of the authentic Catholic tradition. The Catholic tradition, the liturgical rites of the Mass, and the seven sacraments. In a lecture at Fordham University during that time, Bella revealed what would seem to be a prophecy, an uncanny prophecy, of future chaos in the Church. Speaking as a former high-ranking official of the American Communist Party in 1950, a dozen years before Vatican II, Belladonne said this: "The idea was for these men to be ordained and progress to positions of influence and authority as monsignors and bishops. Right now, they are in the highest places of the church, where they're working to bring about change in order to weaken the church's effectiveness against communism. She also said that these changes would be so drastic that you would not recognize the Catholic Church. She was very concerned about these things. Well, there's much more to this story. But let's reflect a moment. This was the decade or two right before the entry of these 1,100 or 1,200 young men, it turned out, about 1,200, that entered the seminaries and were ordained and rose to positions of prominence in the church, ascended the hierarchy. This sequentially occurred just before the epidemic of sexual abuse in the church, sexual abuse of children. The graph of this epidemic suddenly begins in the 60s, goes through the mid-70s, and then falls off again. That's what the graph looks like. Is there a connection? And these young men were being placed as sleepers in the clergy to defame the church, to embarrass the church. Is there a connection? This needs to be more thoroughly investigated. Because these events proceeded in a seemingly causative sequence. First, the infiltration, then the sudden rise in the graph. A steep rise goes on for a little more than 10 years and it falls off. I don't know if you've read the John Jay Report, independent report on the Catholic Church. It took a while, but I did read it, every page. But the report encompassed 52 years, and there was very little sexual abuse until the mid-60s, and then it rose, but then it falls off again. Dramatically falls off to the present state where we have a much reduced number of incidents. There's much more to say on this subject. I'll set that aside for another podcast. I want to say to my listeners that I've sort of had a hobby through the years, actually since I was 16 years old and saw live coverage of the McCarthy Army hearings, the Joseph McCarthy Army hearings, and saw how misreported it was in the evening news. I happened to have been practically bedridden. I had poison ivy breaking out over most of my body as a result of being on an Explorer Scout walk down by the Kentucky River. So I was there and I watched this and I learned a lot. I learned not to trust the three networks, and every night I watched the news and saw it was fake news back then. Really worse, much worse. The three networks had a monopoly on communication, on the transmission of information. Thank God the internet has ended that. There was some powerful bias to try to hide what was being uncovered about communist infiltration of our country. Senator Joe McCarthy tried to expose it, and he was destroyed. He was destroyed with slander, even impeached by the Senate. Senator Tidings did everything he could to block every effort that Joe McCarthy made to again uncover certain communist individuals who had been fired from one department in the government, having been discovered to be members of the Communist Party, but were quickly rehired in some other federal office in Washington, D.C. J. Edgar Hoover had supplied a long list of these to Joseph McCarthy on condition that he not reveal the names. He said, "I have a list." And the press howled at this irresponsible man who had a list of communists working in the federal government but would not reveal the names. He couldn't. His biggest opposition in investigating communists was Senator Millard Tidings of Maryland. There's a great many facts known, and yet some people don't seem to be aware of it. We look at the dissolution of society around us and attribute to all kinds of things. And there are several causes, but there's one great cause. It was not an inevitable regression. And it didn't happen by accident. Is we didn't just slowly evolve here to this depraved popular culture. This was a carefully engineered plan. There's no question about it. I have plans for a lot of podcasts on this subject. I can only cover a little piece at a time. One more thing about Bella. She did make a public affidavit, witnessed by a number of people. In it, she said, "In the late 1920s and 30s, directives were sent from Moscow to all Communist Party organizations. In order to destroy the Roman Catholic Church from within, party members were to be planted in seminaries and within diocesan organizations. I myself put 1,200 men in Roman Catholic seminaries." You might notice that the number went up from 1,100 to 1,200 as she restated it through the years. She said the idea was for these men to be ordained and progress to positions of influence and authority as monsignors and bishops. Remember that earlier she said there were four cardinals. In that lecture at Fordham University, which many listeners said made their hair stand up on the back of their neck, she said that the communist infiltrators are right now occupying some of the highest places in the Catholic Church. I know this is a rather sobering way to end this program, but I so often like to give some inspiration at the end. Let's reflect on this. Let's investigate more. And let's pray. Let's pray a lot for our beloved Catholic Church to come through one more crisis, as it always does. Let's sail on, Bark of Peter. For Setting the Record Straight, this is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com. Thank you.